Welcome to the Science Podcast for November 16th, 2012. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, engineering biomaterials, advanced hunting tools for early humans, and a scourge on North American mussel diversity.
Mussels are really good indicators of the quality of the water. So if you lose the mussels, that's a sign that something's happening with water quality.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Stem cells have been lauded as the future of medicine, with the promise of regrowing any organ or tissue in the body. Yet, as researchers have quickly discovered, not all tissues are easy to regenerate. Kyriakos Athanasio and colleagues review the current state of cartilage regeneration and its future potential. Edward Hermy spoke with Athanasio from his office at UC Davis.
These new disciplines have come about specifically to allow us to regenerate tissues and organs in the human body. So though the terms regenerative medicine and tissue engineering are almost used interchangeably, one needs to make a distinction between the two. When we talk about regenerative medicine, essentially we talk about the use of stem cells. So we can take stem cells and, you know, we can inject them into the tissue of interest in the body, or we can try to induce those stem cells to become the appropriate cell type to make tissue, or we can take those stem cells in vitro and try to convert them into the right cell type and allow those cells to, you know, make tissue. That's regenerative medicine. Tissue engineering, on the other hand, talks about the fabrication, the making of tissues, primarily in vitro, in the laboratory, using cells, biomaterials, or scaffolds, as well as different stimuli that we can use to basically turn the cells on to make the right tissue. Now, though the areas may be different, they overlap in some areas because in tissue engineering, we can also use stem cells to make tissues using biomaterials, using stimuli, etc. So what was predicted perhaps early on hasn't really panned out. A couple of decades ago, all of us, everybody was talking about tissue engineering and regenerative medicine as this panacea. It was going to solve everything. It was going to allow us to make every tissue and every organ in the body. Of course, reality has turned out to be a lot more difficult, and the progress hasn't been as spectacular as we had anticipated, but nevertheless, there are a few bright spots, if you would, where we see some good results.
In your article, you focus on some of these difficulties with regenerative medicines and tissue engineering, especially focusing on cartilage. So first of all, what is cartilage used for in our bodies? I know that I have, you know, cartilage in my ears and nose, but does it have any other uses?
Well, as a matter of fact, the main cartilage of the human body is in the joints, in our knees, in our hips, in our shoulders, in our hand joints, foot joints, etc. And the main function of that cartilage, which is called in this case articular cartilage, is to allow for bones to move on top of each other, you know, to allow for these large ranges of motion that we see in our joints. Mm-hmm. And that is the most usual form of cartilage in the body. Its function is to bear load, a lot of load, a lot of pressure, and also to allow for these effortless motions that we see in the joints. It has an exceptionally low friction. As a matter of fact, it's a material that exhibits the lowest known coefficient of friction anywhere, so much better than any man-made material, which is phenomenal. Yeah. It is also very, very strong material, very strong in the sense that it can take up a lot of pressures, a lot of stresses in the joint. But at the same time, it's supposed to be very flexible, very deformable. That really creates a set of conditions that are very difficult to match when it comes to engineering such tissues.
So this sounds like a tough engineering problem. Is that why it's so much harder to grow cartilage than more complex tissues like bone?
That's right. When people were coming up with the field of tissue engineering, they were saying that the tissues that we're going to engineer first are going to be the relatively flat, two-dimensional kind of tissues like cartilage, tissues that don't have any vascularity like cartilage, that has very few cells like cartilage, no nerves like cartilage. But it turned out not to be the case. The reason is this. In my opinion, articular cartilage is a biomechanical tissue. It operates under extremely strenuous conditions. And if you allow me to make an analogy that may allow our audience to understand what we're talking about.
Yeah, of course.
As I'm getting off a chair, or as I walk up the steps of my staircase in my house, I can generate in my hip pressures, I'm going to give you the numbers, I'm going to explain what they mean, 10 to 15 megapascals of pressure. To give you an idea, that's about 1,500 to 2,000 PSI, pounds per square inch. Keep in mind that in our cars we have, what, 30 PSI in our tires, 30, right? Well, here we're talking about 2,000 PSI. And that happens every time I take a step or I get off the chair. If one looks at these numbers and tries to put them in perspective, think of an elephant of 3,000 kilograms, a large elephant, mm-hmm. standing on your knee for 1 to 2 million cycles a year. So when you realize that we're talking about a tremendous amount of pressure, tremendous amount of stress happening very, very frequently, well, this tissue better really be very, very good, very, very strong, biomechanically extraordinary. And this is exactly where our difficulty has been, to be able to engineer a tissue that can have such incredible biomechanical properties.
So how have efforts to actually grow cartilage, instead of trying to replace it with a biomechanical replacement, but to actually grow what we naturally have, how has that actually progressed?
Well, not exceedingly well. First of all, let's put it this way. Whatever processes we have to regenerate cartilage right now, you know, used clinically or in most experimental procedures, involve what we call focal lesions, meaning small cartilage lesions, less than 2 centimeters in diameter lesions. Mm-hmm. You realize that the cartilage of your knee joint is much larger than that. So we're not even talking about making tissue to cover, say, the entire articular surface. Just keep that in mind first. So the efforts have concentrated on trying to make tissue to replace the small lesions, the focal lesions. But again, because we have not been able to figure out how to make a tissue that has those exceptional properties, these glass-like surfaces that the cartilage has, exceptional frictionless properties, the good mechanics, the good collagen network, we simply have not been able to be very successful. So though we can make tissue that can fill defects, unfortunately, that tissue does not last very long. It degenerates reasonably quickly. So it is not a permanent solution. We haven't been able, in other words, to come up with a process that allows us to come up with a permanent replacement or regeneration of cartilage.
You know, in spite of all these challenges, where do you actually see the future of cartilage engineering going? Where do you see this field headed over the next few years?
I think we're beginning to see a beautiful, beautiful picture emerge. That is a picture in which what I see, what a lot of us see, is the ability to tissue engineer in the laboratory cartilage that has the characteristics of the right cartilage to treat not only small defects, but also large defects, perhaps, you know, a defect that encompasses an entire compartment, say, in the knee joint. We can employ scaffold-less approaches, such as what we use, the self-assembling process, under the right conditions in the laboratory that allows us to engineer these tissues that are shape-specific. Now, remember, say, in the knee joint, our cartilage is not flat. It has a very convoluted radii of curvature. So shape-specific, frictionless, having this coefficient of friction that is incredibly small, very strong, so it can take all of, you know, the elephant walking on my knee, but also wear resistant. So it has to take these loading cycles, millions of them every year for decades of life. And to be able to do that, I think we're finally putting together the appropriate protocols. We are elucidating the mechanisms of cartilage regeneration de novo from scratch in the laboratory. And indeed, what we're getting, we are in my group and other groups, we're beginning to engineer large, shape-specific, biomechanically suitable pieces of cartilage that already our first results in animal studies are quite promising. So where do I see the future? Well, I see the future in exactly that, in the ability to engineer in the laboratory cartilage of the right dimensions, the right shape for treating small but also very large cartilage defects.
Wow. Well, it sounds great. Well, Kyriakos Athanasio, thanks for talking with me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Kyriakos Athanasio and colleagues describe the difficulties of engineering cartilage as part of a special issue on biomaterials. You can read more reviews and commentary on this topic from Science, Science Translational Medicine, and Science Careers at www.sciencemag.org/special/biomaterials.
Once upon a time, freshwater mussels were an important food source for the native peoples of the Americas and a natural filtration system for river water. The southern United States is still host to an amazing diversity of these bivalves, but their decline has been drastic. I spoke with news writer Eric Stockstead about the threats to mussels and their potential rescue.
So a couple of years ago, I was looking at a map of biodiversity in North America. And I was really surprised to see that there's a hot spot of biodiversity in the southeastern U.S. It turns out that what's driving that biodiversity, what's so rich there, are freshwater mussels, fish, crayfish. It's the inhabitants of the streams. And recently I found out that this is actually one of the big conservation crises in North America, that this hot spot of mussel diversity is actually the most threatened group of animals in North America. So I discovered that researchers are making progress understanding what's driving this crisis, and they're making progress in understanding how better to save the mussels.
All right. So, well, let's start with some basics of mussel biology, which comes up as an important point later. What's the life cycle of a typical mussel?
Sarah, this is totally cool, and it got me really excited about these creatures, and it's what gets most researchers really interested in working on these mussels. Freshwater mussels have a parasitic stage of their reproductive cycle. It turns out that the larval mussels, after the female broods these, they have to spend several days to a couple of weeks living on fish gills. That's how they get upstream. If you're a mussel, how do you expand your range against the current? You hitch a ride on a fish. And what's really neat is over millions of years, these mussels have evolved incredible adaptations to try and get their larvae onto the fish gills.
Give me an example.
So there's a variety of strategies that I describe in the paper and in a video if you want to look at it on the website. But one is some mussels have modified their soft tissue. So when the mussels are ready to release their larvae, the mussels come up out of the sediment in the gravel, and they unfurl this lure. They've modified their soft tissue to look like a minnow, and it has the color of a minnow and even a little eye spot. They flick it in the water, so it looks like a swimming minnow. And when a bass or another fish that they're trying to attract is intrigued and comes up and tries to bite this prey to capture it, the mussels release a cloud of these larvae, and the fish will then suck in some of that larvae as it's pulling water into its mouth. Those larvae will pass over the gills of the water, and some of them will be able to clamp their tiny little shells onto the gill filament.
Huh.
And that's where they mature for a couple of weeks until they drop off and settle into their new habitat.
Wow. Well, so you were saying this is just one of many, many strategies that the mussels take on. But do scientists know why there's such a diversity of mussels in the U.S.?
That's really interesting because you think of the tropics as being hotspots of biodiversity, right? You think of the tropics and rainforest. And there are streams in the southeastern U.S. that have more species of mussel living in 10 miles of river than occur in all of Europe or all of the rainforest. What's special about North America, especially the southern part of North America, is that it's been very stable for tens of millions of years geologically. So you have many isolated rivers where species can evolve, and these rivers have constant water flow. The water has just the right amount of nutrient. It doesn't have too much silt, like rivers in the Amazon are way too silty for mussels. And it wasn't glaciated. Europe, glaciated. You lose all the mussels in the last ice age. Southern U.S. was a refugia from the glaciers that came down from Canada.
So what are the major threats that researchers have found out are dangerous to mussels?
Probably the biggest thing that happened to mussels was when major dams were built in the U.S. And as soon as that happened, massive reservoirs were created, and these mussels that are adapted to live in clear, quickly flowing rivers, suddenly they're buried in this deep water, dozens of mussels went extinct. And the habitat was just really altered. Upstream, it's reservoirs. Downstream, the water can be too silty or too cold or not have enough oxygen. That was really the biggest thing that happened to the mussels. There are other things that have happened since. So water quality. Mussels are really good indicators of the quality of the water. So if you lose the mussels, that's a sign that something's happening with water quality, be it problems from mining or silt from deforestation or just agricultural runoff or sewage from cities. So we lost a lot of mussels early in the 20th century. But we're also losing a lot of mussels now. And in some cases, it seems kind of mysterious. Even now, you can have populations that over a decade will drop by 90%. They seem healthy. You look at it, you find a lot of adult mussels there. But these populations are just winking out.
And why do they think that there's this die-off?
It seems like there are a lot of mussel populations that are having problems producing the next generation. They seem to be making larvae, but they just can't get juvenile mussels. So one reason, and this is really insidious if you think about it, is that the host fish that these mussels are adapted to, they may be cut off by a dam. So suddenly you have mussels above the dam, and the host fish is down below the dam and can't get to the mussels. So the mussels are, they're generating larvae, but there's no host for them to mature on, and they can live for 100 years. You could have a population of adults that every year is trying to make juveniles, but there's no host fish. And so when these mussels all become, you've got this retirement community of mussels, and then boom, 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 they all die off and the population's gone. There's one other thing that is also really problematic, and it turns out that researchers are finding out that water quality can somehow impact how these mussels are reproducing or how the larvae turn into juvenile mussels. For example, one recent discovery was that the amount of ammonia in the sediment is really a big important factor in whether they can reproduce or not. And this ammonia can come from fertilizer running off from fields, for example. So even if the host fish is there, if the water quality isn't good enough, the mussels may not be able to reproduce and the population will just slowly slide to nothing.
So what have researchers been able to figure out about, you know, new ways of protecting these mussels, their delicate life cycles?
A number of things are happening. One is there are ways you can modify a dam to make the water quality below the dam better for mussels. You can add more oxygen as the water comes out, and this has been shown to really make a big difference. You can boost mussel populations. Another thing is just basically cleaning up the water. If you have better sewage treatment plants, if you can prevent fertilizer or manure from running off into the stream, that can make a big difference as well. Now, one of the things that's really a big effort is to try and boost the number of endangered species, because you can have a species where we only know that it occurs in this 1 mile of river. Mm-hmm. And so if something catastrophic happens, and you want to make sure that you've got more than just one population left. So there's a lot of work figuring out how to cultivate endangered species in the laboratory, propagate them so you can then release thousands of mussels and help create more populations around to make sure that they don't get wiped out by a tragic event.
Right. It must be kind of challenging to grow these mussels in a lab or in a farm setting because they have such complicated life cycles.
That's right. The first thing is if you have an endangered species, you're only allowed to take 5 females out of the wild and then you have to put them back. But while you have them in the lab, you either have to know what the host fish species is or figure that out. And then what you do is you try and match the species in the tank with fish that you bring in and figure out, now, what kind of fish does this mussel need? That's actually the easier part. Once you figure that out, you've got to figure out how to really take care of these larval mussels that are less than a millimeter, and they're very sensitive to what's in the water. And you have to make sure you're feeding them the right things. So that can take years to figure out what are the right conditions. And for some species, they've figured it out.
So some of the scientists in your story make a monetary case for mussel preservation, that there's some financial impact here. What is that?
This is really just beginning, but it's a larger concept that's happening in conservation more broadly called ecosystem services. And the idea is if you can figure out what these species do you can make the case that they're actually providing a valuable service, not just to the ecosystem, but to humans as well. And for mussels, mussels are incredibly good at filtering water. They used to be the largest amount of biomass in these rivers. There were incredible shoals of mussels, and they would filter out particles and bacteria and all sorts of things and then convert it into food and energy that other parts of the ecosystem could use. So recent research has shown that mussels actually help the terrestrial ecosystem, and the way they do that is by converting detritus in the river into forms that insects can use, that algae can use. For humans, well, the idea is that if you have enough mussels in the river, you may be able to rely on these mussels instead of expensive water filtration plants to help keep those rivers clean.
All right. Well, Eric, thanks for talking with me.
It was a lot of fun, Sarah.
Eric Stockstad is a staff news writer for Science. He writes about protecting mussels in this week's issue.
Spears and tools with handles, or hafts, were a tremendous advancement for early human hunters. Around 200 to 300,000 years ago, both Homo sapiens and Neanderthals are believed to have been using hafted tools. But did each evolve tool-making skills independently, or did a common ancestor pass them down to us? The recent discovery of hafted stone points that date back hundreds of thousands of years earlier may hold clues to the answer. I spoke with Jane Wilkins about this exciting development.
What we found was that stone points dating to 500,000 years ago were used as spear tips. So these points would have been attached to long wooden shafts and used to hunt game. We know that early humans often attached stone points to the end of spears and that it was a common practice after about 300,000 years ago, but the antiquity of this behavior wasn't known until now.
So what's the significance of finding spear points? I mean, how exactly does a stone point get attached to a spear shaft, and how important is that in the context of the advancement of stone tools?
Right. So when a stone tool is attached to a wooden or bone handle, we call that hafting, and it is a very significant advancement in technology for our human ancestors because hafting requires multiple materials. Stone, wood, and also the binding materials. It requires multiple steps, it requires foreplanning and goal-oriented behavior, and making a multiple component tool takes significantly more time than making a single component tool.
And so accurately timing these into human history is actually really important for how we advanced as a species.
Right. It's really interesting, actually. Some researchers have linked hafting to language because combining multiple tool components in a way is analogous to constructing a grammatical sentence. So it is a very significant find.
Oh, how interesting. So the stone points that you were studying here were found at a site called Catupan 1. It sounds like a really interesting field area. So can you describe to me where it is, what it looks like, and you know what other sort of things have been found there?
So Catupan 1 is located in the Northern Cape Province in the interior of South Africa. It's about 5 kilometers from the town of Katiu. And a pan is basically a seasonal lake or pond. And there are actually numerous sites at Catupan. The pan probably served as a source of water and a central location for foraging humans in the past. Peter Beaumont from the McGregor Museum actually found and excavated the site in the early 1980s. And it's a very exceptional site with more than 5 meters of archaeological deposits that are extremely rich in stone tool artifacts and animal remains. So in 2010, Michael Chazin and a team of researchers reopened the original excavations and they took samples for dating analysis. And they found that the sediments containing the points dated to 500,000 years ago. And it wasn't until this recent study that we actually appreciated the antiquity of the sediments there.
So tell me about the points that you found. What's the evidence that these were hafted to spears?
Okay, well, the points are similar in form to points from more recent contexts that we know were used by Neanderthals and modern humans as spear tips. And that in itself is suggestive. But sometimes there's evidence that points were used for other tasks like butchery or cutting and scraping hides. So we really wanted to determine whether the points were actually used as spear tips. So to do that, we looked at the damage and breakage patterns along the edges of the points. And our experimental research shows that when points are used as spear tips, they have a high concentration of damage at the tip, and that the fractures at the tips exhibit certain characteristics that are diagnostic of impact with hard objects.
Hmm.
And we found that the 500,000-year-old points exhibited the same damage and breakage patterns as our experimental spear tips.
Can you give me a couple of examples of the particular damage that would be specific to this kind of point?
The what we call diagnostic impact fractures have a certain kind of initiation that we call a bending initiation, and then they terminate in a certain way, and we call that a step termination. And there's a whole field of research looking at how those kinds of fractures occur very rarely when tools are used for other purposes or from post-depositional processes, right? Because sometimes stones just break because they're in the ground. But this specific type of fracture hardly ever occurs just from those kinds of processes.
So you even carried out some experiments of your own to test the wear and tear that might happen to stone points on spears. So tell me about those experiments.
Right. So with my co-authors, Ben Scoville and Kyle Brown, we did these spearing experiments. They have been using this contraption they manufactured, which consists of a crossbow, the kind of crossbow used by recreational hunters today, mounted onto a stand. And this setup allows for replicated spears to be carefully aimed at a target, and our target was a hanging antelope carcass. We constructed experimental spears from locally available raw materials. So Kyle Brown replicated the points using the same kind of stone that was used to make the Catupan points. And then we used sticky resin from acacia trees and sinew from the antelope to attach these replicate points to wooden dowel. And then basically we used the crossbow to spear the antelope carcass. And then this gives us the expected pattern of breakage for points used as spear tips.
Out of curiosity, where did you obtain the antelope carcasses?
They get culled from a game farm nearby. So this farmer kind of has like a huge population of springbok on his farm, and he has to control the population by culling them. So he sells us the springbok carcasses.
So no springbok were actually harmed in the making of this experiment. They were given to you already dead.
They were already dead, yes.
So what does all of this tell us about early humans? You know, what's the big picture here in terms of human evolution?
It tells us a number of things. First, it tells us that stone-tipped spears were used by the ancestor of both modern humans and Neanderthals. It was not an independent invention by each species and not something that one group learned from the other. Second, it expands the range of behavioral complexity for our human ancestors 500,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We know from fossils that brain size increased 500,000 years ago. But prior to now, there was no significant behavioral changes detected in the archaeology for this time. But these points do represent a very significant behavioral change with big implications for how human ancestors 500,000 years ago thought, how they communicated, and how they hunted.
So your paper puts these hafted spear points in the hands of Homo heidelbergensis, who are the common ancestor of humans and Neanderthals, or so we think. How can you be so sure that it was this species that was creating and using these spears?
Well, it's the age of the Catupan points. So 500,000 years ago is coeval with fossils attributed to Homo heidelbergensis. And Homo heidelbergensis is the species generally considered to be the last common ancestor of Neanderthals and Homo sapiens. And these fossils date to about 600 and 400,000 years ago. They're found in Africa and Europe. We also have genetic studies that situate the human Neanderthal divergence to between 800 and 400,000 years ago. So based on the timing, the Catupan points were manufactured by a human ancestor that predates or is very close to the divergence of the human and Neanderthal lineages. And in a way, that helps explain why there are similarities between the kinds of behaviors that modern humans do and Neanderthals do. And one of those similarities is making hafted spears.
Very interesting. Well, Jane Wilkins, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jane Wilkins and colleagues discuss early hafted hunting technology in a report this week.
Finally today, I'm here with news writer Carolyn Gramling, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So, Carolyn, our first story is about disappointing news from a malaria vaccine trial.
Yes, this has been an ongoing trial. They actually presented the first results of this large-scale trial, which is to test this particular vaccine for malaria in sub-Saharan Africa. And it's the first phase 3 trial, which means it's a very large-scale trial for a malaria vaccine. And last year, they presented the first results from it on older infants and toddlers. And they found somewhat promising results, so that they were sort of feeling hopeful about it. They found that it prevented malaria in about 50% of the children. But this year, they were looking at some more of the data, and they presented results from even younger infants, so about 6 to 12 weeks of age. And what they found was that instead of preventing malaria in 50% of the kids, it was only about 30%.
So this was really a much lower effective rate than what they had found last year.
Yes, it was somewhat of a disappointment, I think, although they are still spinning it as somewhat hopeful. It doesn't mean that they are giving up on it.
Do they have any sort of explanations for why this might be so much less effective amongst younger babies?
They have a couple of ideas about why that might be, and I think these are results that they're going to be continuing to look at and present in a couple of years in 2014. But what they suspect is that younger babies have less developed immune systems, that they may contain still some lingering antibodies from their mothers. And it may also be just that where they tested the vaccine before was in places where there was a more moderate number of cases of malaria, and they were testing it this time in much more malaria-prone areas.
And like you said, this trial is ongoing. These are only early results. When is the trial slated to be over with?
Well, they're hoping to have all of the data processed and analyzed by 2014, and that's when they're actually expecting to present the final results of the trial.
Now, why is it so difficult to create a vaccine for malaria?
Well, it's interesting. Most vaccines actually for bacteria and for viruses, they have maybe a 90% effectiveness rate. In this case, you know, 50% was good news last year when they found it. And that's because the malaria parasite is actually a really difficult target. It has a very complex life cycle. And so they've found it to be really tricky to find an effective vaccine for. In this case, they're not saying this is a complete waste. At this point, they're still hopeful for it. And also that they want to combine the protection from this vaccine with, for example, bed nets, which is another way of preventing contracting malaria.
And disappointment aside, this is still the furthest that any malaria vaccine has come within clinical trials.
Yes, this is the first case where they've actually done a phase 3 large-scale test of a malaria vaccine.
Well, I look forward to hearing the results. Moving on, we've got a story about the culinary preferences of human ancestors.
Yes, indeed, and how they are actually different from ape ancestors. There was an interesting shift that happened about 4 million years ago. We don't actually know exactly when, where the diet of early hominins, early human ancestors, changed from being primarily fruits and seeds to being grasses.
So we knew that that transition probably happened at some point. So what's significant about this study?
Well, one thing was that they were aware that this happened because they noticed changes in the shape of the teeth. They saw that they began to have thicker enamel, larger molars and premolars, which does suggest a change in diet, but they weren't actually able to say for sure that that change in diet had occurred.
So how did they determine that in this study?
Well, what they did was they actually found that there's a new technique that they're actually able to use to look at fossilized teeth. In the past, they weren't actually able to sample these for chemical analyses because it was a little bit too destructive to the fossils. But now they're actually able to do that. And what they were looking for in the tooth enamel was carbon isotopes. So the stable isotopes of carbon 13 and 12 occur in particular ratios in different kinds of plants. And you can actually use that, how that accumulates in the body, to track what the creature was eating, what the individual was eating.
Oh, very interesting. So what does this tell us in general about, you know, early human evolution?
Well, what they found was that they looked at these three individuals who were from a particular species that lived about 4 million years ago, and the fossils were found in Chad, in what is today Chad. And the species were called Australopithecus Bahril-Ghazali.
It's a mouthful.
Yes. They're actually very closely related to the more famous fossil Lucy, which is an Australopithecus afarensis. And they looked at the teeth of these three individuals, and they found that they actually showed the carbon isotope ratio that is more distinctive of grasses as opposed to fruits and seeds that were found in the forests. It suggests that these individuals were actually beginning to adapt, that they were no longer just sticking to the forested areas, but they were actually learning to adapt to more open grasslands.
How interesting. And our third story is a really strange but incredible mix of science and art.
Yes, there's a movement out there, so to speak, to use dance as a way of expressing one's scientific research. And, you know, we actually have a contest that we hold every year here called Dance Your PhD.
Right.
And so there was actually a team of scientists. Well, it was a scientist and the artistic director of a theater and dance department. And together, they were interested in using dance as a way to communicate science to the public.
How did an idea like this get started?
Well, actually, I think Dance Your PhD was somewhat of the inspiration for some of this. They wanted to sort of talk about the scientists' research and find a way to sort of do this communication, and they had a grant to do this. But as they started exploring how to do that, they got a little bit caught up with the idea of, could you actually use dance not just to explain results, but to try and assess hypotheses?
So this isn't just interpretive dance, it's actually sort of feeding back into the original science?
Yes, exactly. What they did was they had these dancers inside of a cage, which sort of simulated the walls of a cell, and they wanted to figure out, could we tell them to move in certain ways, like run over on one side of the cell only, or never increase your speed as you bounce into each other? And can we use the dancers to simulate large molecules within a cell and figure out how do those molecules bounce into each other and interact? And if we tell them to do all these things, can we sort of develop an idea about whether or not a particular hypothesis of movement is a bad idea or worth pursuing further?
So has there been any actual published research to come out of this?
As a matter of fact, there has. There was an article that was published online this month, which showed basically that using this dance motion, which they call body storming rather than brainstorming, is an effective way to get a quick assessment of whether a particular hypothesis is even worth pursuing. And they found that it actually is an effective shortcut to doing that.
How cool. And what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, this week on Science Now, we have stories about a new analysis of Einstein's brain, a long-awaited story, and also a story about, are we overestimating drought worldwide? Is the model that we're using causing that overestimation? And on our online policy blog, Science Insider, we have ongoing stories about the aftermath of the election. And in particular, we're looking at the three candidates who may potentially lead the House Science Committee. So we have interviews with them and close looks at each of them.
And this is in the U.S.?
And this is in the U.S. And finally, on Science Live, we have a live chat on crop genomes and GM crops and what will the food of the future look like. So stay tuned for all of those stories.
Great. Thanks, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Carolyn Gramling is a news writer for Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. And while you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the November 16th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.